A goose could recognize its partner from miles away. And we think we're so special, Dan said. He got it. And this was when she started falling for him. True love and all that. You think we're as random as the geese? But the tragedy, she said, is that knowing it doesn't change a thing. And here, 100 and some years on, was Ranko Novak. A face among the faces. A goose like all the other geese. He was gone, and Nora was gone. And what had happened to the passion that had consumed them both? If Fiona could convince herself that it was floating around the world, just disembodied, leftover passion, wouldn't that be a wonderful thing to believe? At 2 in the afternoon, Cecily called and said she'd changed her mind. She was about to board her connection at O'Hare and would be there late tonight. She didn't need a hotel. An old college friend lived in the Latin Quarter. "I won't be in your way," she said. "I'll work on Kurt. And then, do you think I should bring presents? For the little girl?" At 5 o'clock, Fiona unwrapped her bandage to apply the ointment the doctor had given her. Her hand was hurting less. It was amazing how quickly you could forget physical pain. How soon you couldn't even summon its echo. At 8, Jake called. Serge had given him the number. He wondered if she'd come out and grab a bite. She was tired, she said, and managed to hang up. She'd have to have a word with Serge. At 9:45, lying in bed, she started hearing sirens. Far too many, for far too long. At 9:50, her phone started ringing. First Damien and then Jake. Frantic, cryptic questions about where she was. "Stay inside," they said. Then Richard was knocking on her door. She came out to the living room to watch the news. She stood in her nightgown, her feet cold. Serge paced the floor, swearing. Richard lay on the couch. Fiona made herself breathe. The attacks were far enough from here that she tried to imagine she was home, hearing about something on the far side of the world. There was no chance Claire had been out at what sounded like some kind of heavy metal concert. A person's tastes couldn't change that much. She might have been at that restaurant, or walking down that sidewalk, but the odds were small. The soccer stadium was up in Saint-Denis, where Claire lived. That worried her most. But Claire had a young child, and it was so late at night. Claire had her number, at least. But why hadn't Fiona tackled her and made her write down her own? She didn't have Kurt's, either. Running around the city to search for her was out of the question. She should go get a sweater, but she didn't want to move. There was nothing to do but keep calm. Cecily was in the air, then hopefully they'd let her plane land. What were the odds that Claire would show up for work tomorrow morning? What were the odds that the city would be thrown into such chaos that Fiona would never find her again? She was surprised by her numbness, at least regarding the televised carnage, the bloodied, sobbing people on the streets. Was it because it wasn't her city? Or because the rituals of outrage and grief and fear felt so familiar now, so practiced? Or maybe it was the pain pills she'd popped after dinner for her hand. She was struck by the selfish thought that this was not fair to her. That she'd been in the middle of a different story, one that had nothing to do with this. She was a person who was finding her daughter, making things right with her daughter. And there was no room in that story for the idiocy of extreme religion, the violence of men she'd never met. Just as she'd been in the middle of a story about divorce when the towers fell in New York City, throwing everyone's careful plans to shit. Just as she'd once been in a story about raising her own brother, growing up with her brother in the city on their own, making it in the world, when the virus and the indifference of greedy men had steamrolled through. She thought of Nora, whose art and love were interrupted by assassination and war. stupid men and their stupid violence, tearing apart everything good that was ever built. Why couldn't you ever just go after your life without tripping over some idiot's dick? Richard's show. No one knew if the preview could happen on Monday as planned. His publicist called, and his manager. They need to calm down, Richard said. You'd think they'd have better things to worry about. Serge said, We're screwed. The whole world is screwed. He hadn't stopped moving for the last hour and a half. I don't mean to sound callous, Fiona said, but we've been through this in the States. And it's not... No, Serge said. Whatever, 100 dead people, I don't care. That could have been a bus crash. What I care is, now they elect right-wing across Europe. And then, yes, you, me, all of us, we're screwed. Everyone acts from fear. The next year, 2 years. What happens, you think, to people like us? Fiona felt herself sinking. She said, Things might seem different in the morning. Serge wheeled on her. When people are afraid, we get the Christian Taliban. We get it here, you get it there, and we're all in jail. We're all in jail. Richard had been so quiet for so long that Fiona kept wondering if he'd fallen asleep. He stretched his arms overhead and said, Serge, that's enough. I'm going out there. Serge grabbed his helmet from the counter. Hollande can fuck his curfew. Fiona expected Richard to stop him, expected Serge to stop himself, but Serge was out the door. Richard's phone rang again, but he ignored it. I didn't mean to offend him, she said. I'm not naive, you know that. He said, It's always a matter, isn't it, of waiting for the world to come unraveled? When things hold together, it's always only temporary. 1986. Roman had a scar on the meat of his left arm from his smallpox vaccine. An indented circle made of 1,000 tiny dots. Yale could put his thumb there. He could put his tongue there. Roman would come over drunk. It seemed to take some alcohol to get him to show up without all the baggage of 27 years of Mormonism. Roman would call at 8 p.m. on a Saturday and say he'd be over in a while. But he wouldn't come till after midnight. And during that time, Yale would blast music, start drinking himself. Because he didn't want to go out and miss Roman. But it was pathetic to sit there on the couch watching reruns and waiting. Roman had silver fillings in his molars, and he always needed to blow his nose after he came. Roman would show up like rain, once every couple of weeks, then he'd stay till 4 in the morning, leaving before the city woke up. Every time, as he put his shoes on, he'd say, I don't know what I'm doing. And Yale would think, but not say, that they were both lost in the woods. Only Roman thought Yale knew the way out. Roman liked to do it spooning on their sides, his chest against Yale's back. He'd drench both of them with sweat. He would groan, shaking, into Yale's hair. The first few times he was too fast, too spastic. Then he relaxed, learned to slow down, started to seem like he actually enjoyed it, and it wasn't a thing to race through in shame. Now he'd even stick around and talk afterward. Roman said, No offense, and it's a good thing, but your dick is like a fucking pepper grinder. I mean, I've never seen, like, I don't really... And Yale said, Don't worry, I'm not going to try to fuck you. Yale asked Roman if he'd thought about going to the Pride Parade, which was 10 days away. They were starting to sober up. It was 3 in the morning. Just being counted matters, Yale said. and heard how we sounded like Charlie. Last year we had 35,000. Roman rolled toward Yale and grinned, his eyes mole-like without his glasses. You're saying size matters to you. I'm saying we want to top that. Roman laughed, ran a finger up Yale's groin. It'd be good for you. There's something about seeing some drag queen doing a pole dance in a flatbed right there in the street that makes it easier to go back to work the next day and not worry about being a little faggy. Not that Yale went to work anymore. And also... But Roman sank his teeth into the top of Yale's ear, moved his hand up his side. Also, it's educational. You're educational. Yale hadn't heard from Roman since that night. Then meanwhile, he decided he might not even go to the parade himself. He bought a ticket for the Cubs-Mets game, which wouldn't start till 3:30, but at least gave him a fairly solid excuse. One he used when Asher called the day before the parade, and asked if Yale could lend a hand on the AIDS Foundation of Chicago float. Actually, Asher said, it's not your hands we want. It's your cute face. We're wearing clothes, no Speedos involved. Unless you want to, of course. Who am I to stop you? Yale would have done just about anything else for Asher, but he couldn't be in a parade. Couldn't roll down the street past everyone he knew. Couldn't run into Charlie in the staging area. Ross, the redhead who'd been flirting with Yale in the Marina City gym for the past month, said if Yale wanted to hang out, some friends would be watching from a fire escape at Wellington and Clark, with mojitos. Yale didn't want to lead Ross on, but the setup was appealing. When he first moved to the city, he'd been in love with all the fire escapes. Kept feeling Audrey Hepburn might appear there with her guitar, her hair wrapped in a towel, that she might sing him Moon River and grab his hand and pull him across town. He had a mental list of reasons not to go. He wanted to see Sandberg face off against Gooden. He didn't want to stand there getting turned on by beautiful shirtless men just to come home and jerk off sadly in the bathroom. He didn't feel like worrying about how he looked. Scanning the crowd constantly for friends and former friends. He did not want to watch the Out Loud float go by. Plus, he worried every year that this would be the time someone would set off a bomb, open fire on the crowd. He'd watched on the news last night as 1,000 KKK supporters filled a park in a black neighborhood on the southwest side. Yesterday it was racial slurs they were shouting. But they'd announced their plan to rally again in Lincoln Park before the parade. In the free speech area. It couldn't end well. Over the past 4 months, he'd contacted every place he could think of. Even the aquarium and the planetarium, small places in Michigan, remote university galleries where he had no contacts. His CV was strong, but no one seemed to be hiring for more than grant writing. He'd been replaced at the brig. Had gone in for the last time in early April. Cecily still had her job. The gallery was in good shape. The lawsuit was off, and Chuck Donovan had moved on to other ego battles. Yale called Bill once in a while to check in, and learned that the restorations on the Modiglianis and the Abu Tern painting were going to take much longer than anyone had thought. Bill was beginning to doubt the show could go up next year. Yale himself had deleted the section of tape where Nora had talked about painting on Renko's behalf. One small step, he said to Roman, in my journey to becoming Richard Nixon. The Sharps had come to town for a week in April, and Yale had kept out of their way as best he could. He hid Roscoe over at Asher's place, where Roscoe got noticeably fatter. Alan, just because he called Yale up that one time, felt personally responsible for Yale quitting, despite everything Yale had told them both. They doubled down on their insistence that he stay there. They'd be in Barcelona for the summer anyway. The morning of the parade, he tried calling Roman with the excuse of talking him into going. When Roman didn't answer, he found himself unduly disappointed. Out of proportion with how much he actually cared about Roman, which was only somewhat. Roman was fun and Maybe Roman was therapy, but Roman certainly wasn't the only man in the world. Which was another reason to go to the parade himself. At 11, the phone rang. Eniel answered, "Sharp residence, as always," although no one ever seemed to call for the Sharps. It was his father's low, lazy grumble asking how everything was. The way an underpaid nurse might, poking her head into your room to make sure you didn't need the bedpan changed. Yell said, "I'm fine. I'm great." "I'm sitting here doing the crossword myself." "Okay. I'll thank you if you can give me a 6-letter word for harpy. I was sitting here the longest time thinking it said happy, but no, it's harpy." His father was the slowest talker in the world, a trait that drove Yell crazy in adolescence. "I got nothing." "What are you up to these days?" There was no way to answer. Yale hadn't told him about the breakup, just the move. He'd never even told him he'd left the Art Institute last summer. The AIC was something his father had actually heard of, something he took some mode of pride in. And although surely he'd heard of Northwestern as well, Yale had figured he'd leave well enough alone. He could have talked about the Cubs game, but instead he said, "I'm on my way to a parade." Because now that his father's voice was wrapping its way around his right ear, now that going to a ball game would have felt tainted by his father's approval, it was true. He was going to the parade. "What kind of parade?" "A really gay one, Dad. A big gay parade." Yale read in his father's silence a kind of sarcasm. "Listen to yourself," the silence said. "Do you hear how ridiculous that sounds?" Yale said, "So I kind of need to run." He thought his father would hang up, glad for the dismissal, but instead he said, "Listen, have you been following the news on this disease?" Yale found himself stretching the phone cord to the window just so he could make incredulous eye contact with his own reflection. "No, Dad, I haven't. What disease would that be?" "It's... are you being ironic with me? I can never tell. You know, the parade is starting. I really have to go." "All right, then." By the time he got to Clark, the route was packed, and the first few floats had gone by. He wound his way behind people, looking for someone he recognized. At Wellington, he looked for Ross and his friends and their fire escape, but not too hard. After 2 blocks, he spotted Katsu Tatami across the street. Then when a few people ran across behind the Anheuser-Busch float, he crossed too. He didn't know the guys Katsu was standing with, but Katsu was always good for a hug, an enthusiastic greeting. He had to shout in Yale's ear, "So far, so good. You want my soda?" He thrust a McDonald's cup at Yale, and a thought about germs flashed across Yale's mind, but he willfully ignored it. He took a sip and then wished he hadn't. Warm, flat sugar water. A bunch of Harleys rolled past, followed by a lesbian dojo, women kicking and chopping their way down the street, dressed in white. Miss Gay Wisconsin, earnest middle-aged women with P-flag signs. A huge brass bed pulled by a convertible, then occupied by 2 men making out with tremendous gusto, their torsos bare above a thin white sheet. Yale asked Katsu how he was, and Katsu said, "I'm becoming a legal expert." He explained, shouted, that he'd gotten new insurance 2 years ago. In January, he was feeling terrible and finally got tested. And he had it, did Yale know? Yeah, son of a bitch. He hadn't even told his mom. And his goddamned insurance was trying to claim that the virus was a pre-existing condition so they wouldn't have to cover it. "Even though I got the insurance before the fucking test came out. But they're claiming I should have known because 3 years ago I was treated for thrush." One time. And that's enough for them to turn me down. He needed pentamidine treatments. And he'd need hospital care that wasn't at fucking County, where he'd been a couple times. And was Yale aware what it smelled like in there? There was a reason it was free. So Asher was helping him apply for the Social Security he had to have before he could get Medicaid. Because apparently that was how things worked in this stupid country. And do you know what we have to prove? Okay, this is insane. We have to prove I'm disabled. Which I am now, because I could work maybe 4 days a week, but the fifth day I get the runs so bad I'm glued to the bathroom floor. This was tenable for his part-time gig at Howard Brown, but not for the administrative assistant work that used to pay the bills and supply the useless insurance. But the runs aren't a disability category, you know? So Asher's finding me this junior litigator, I guess? And here's what he has to prove at this hearing. He has to show that I can't do any unskilled, sedentary labor in the national economy. Like, the entire nation. And the fucking examples they use! You want to hear the examples? Yale was exhausted just listening to Katsu. But sure, he wanted to hear. A drag queen passed on stilts in an elaborate Statue of Liberty costume. All green sparkles and gauze. I shit you not. Nut sorter. That's not a euphemism, by the way. Bowling ball polisher. Also not a euphemism. Silverware wrapper. Like, sitting there wrapping silverware in napkins. Everyone wants their spoons handled by a guy with the AIDS runs, right? Wafer topper. I don't even know what that means. The last one, for real, is fish hook inspector in Alaska. They don't care that I can't get to Alaska and I could never get this job. They care that it's a job in the national economy. So yeah, my survival now depends on my proving I can't top wafers. Here came a bunch of guys in leather, a poster that read, Bound Up with Pride. Some kind of garden club followed. But I'm gonna get in on whatever clinical trials I can, meantime. And Asher's helping, Yale said. Yeah, Asher. He can sort my nuts whenever he wants, am I right? Yale felt his face catch fire. Oh, come on. You'd let him polish your bowling balls. Yale attempted a noncommittal laugh. And here, ridiculously, before he could properly recover, was Asher's AFC float. Here was Asher, waving like a politician. Yale waved, but he didn't catch Asher's eye. Three guys on unicycles came next, cutoffs and denim vests. A series of aldermen and state senators in convertibles, most looking pained. The Out Loud float. A red flatbed truck. Yale took a small step back so Katsu couldn't see his face, so he didn't have to worry what his eyes and mouth were doing. Poster board signs all over it. Fight Out Loud for safer sex. And Out Loud says, cover your head. Six beautiful shirtless men. Yale didn't recognize them, except for Dwight the copy editor, angling cucumbers from their crotches, slowly rolling rubbers onto them. Peeling them off, doing it again. Opening new packets with their teeth, milking the crowd for cheers. From the side of the truck, Gloria and Raphael threw rubbers from a bucket. He couldn't see Charlie. And then suddenly he could. He had shaved his beard. He was the one holding the boombox that blasted, You Spin Me Round. Yale tried to wrap his mind around the irony of the whole thing. But his body was busy reacting with some strange combination of high and low blood pressure. A Trojan hit Katsu on the chest and he caught it, laughing, and handed it to Yale. He said, I'm a lifestyles man. You want? Then although Yale could not see an occasion in which he'd want to use a rubber that had come indirectly from Charlie, he stuck it in the pocket of his shorts. He'd need to get used to them. until he'd redone the test in March, until Dr. Chang had told him that again the ELISA was negative, though this time he really had made Yale wait 2 weeks, as he'd vowed. Yale had barely let himself ejaculate in the same room as Roman. Lately, since the second negative, he'd been letting Roman suck him off. Though what did lately really mean, when it was all so sporadic? Yale wished the out-loud float would disappear, but it was still making its slow way down Clark. Trojan still flying. Someone scratched him between the shoulder blades, and he turned to see Teddy grinning, bouncing. "Look who came out of hiding," Teddy said. Yale should have known that Teddy might have been part of Katsu's group. And honestly, it was good to see him. Good especially that Teddy was talking as if he didn't think Yale was a monster. Teddy told them about the clan activity in the park. He said, "They're gone now. They didn't want to actually see any of this, you know? They left right before the parade started." Katsu said, "I bet half are secretly sticking around. Bet they're jacking off under their robes." "Only one guy had a robe, actually. I found that so disappointing. They had, like, combat gear, with these weird little shields." Yale said, "What do they even want, besides attention?" "According to their giant banner, they want to quarantine the queers. Real original. Anyway, we yelled back for a long time, and these dykes made out right in front of them. Then they just packed up. I stuck around to talk to a reporter. Anyone want a hot dog? I'm starving." There was no point in trying to move till the parade was over. Then when it finally was, they followed the crowd to the park for the rally. Katsu took off, and Yale found himself alone with Teddy in an endless line for food. Yale said, "I hope we're still friends." "I was mad at you, but it was temporary. I was judging you for being judgmental. Ironic, right?" "I'm not sure I was being judgmental. I know that for you the news was Charlie testing positive, but for me the news was him cheating on me. Maybe everyone else already knew, but I didn't. And things hadn't been great between us for a long time. We actually... he accused me of sleeping with you, the night of Nico's memorial." Teddy whistled between his teeth. "Yeah, I don't remember fucking you." He laughed. "Must not have been that good." The line lurched, and Yale checked to make sure the guys behind them were strangers. He said, "I feel like we're all caught up in some huge cycle of judgment. We spent our whole lives unlearning it, and here we are." "The thing is," Teddy said, "the disease itself feels like a judgment. We've all got a little Jesse Helms on our shoulder, right? If you got it from sleeping with 1,000 guys, then it's a judgment on your promiscuity. If you got it from sleeping with one guy once, that's almost worse. It's like a judgment on all of us. Like, the act itself is the problem, and not the number of times you did it. And if you got it because you thought you couldn't, it's a judgment on your hubris. And if you got it because you knew you could and you didn't care, it's a judgment on how much you hate yourself. Isn't that why the world loves Ryan White so much? How could God have it out for some poor kid with a blood disorder? But then people are still being terrible. They're judging him just for being sick, not even for the way he got it." Yale tended to find Teddy mentally draining, but he was right this time. Way over at the bandstand, Mayor Washington had begun to speak. "As a black man who has suffered discrimination," he was saying, "as part of a race of people who have suffered." And Teddy said, "He's a good one, yeah? We lucked out. He'll be up for re-election by the time we get out of this line." Teddy said, "Check out the cast of the Addams Family over there." Yale looked and couldn't see. 3 o'clock, behind the guy with the bird." Yale saw, first, a dark-haired man with a blue and green macaw perched on his shoulder. He was laughing with someone, and for a second it was hard to look at anything other than this beautiful man and his beautiful bird. But then behind him, Yale saw a group of terribly chic young people, all dressed in black. One of them was Roman. Yale started to wave, but stopped. He had never seen Roman's friends. And this wasn't what he'd pictured. Two tall, pale, handsome men who may or may not have been gay. But given the surroundings, probably were. And a young woman with waist-length blonde hair, a silver ring in her nose. What on earth had he imagined? He hadn't let himself think about it that much, was the thing. In general, the more he thought about Roman, the more confused he became. Roman was best as a shadow that came in the night, an empty screen onto which he could project whatever he wanted. Roman was not the kind of person who showed up to Pride, on his own, with fabulous friends Yale had never heard about. Roman stayed home and worked on his dissertation. Teddy said, "I know the one with glasses."
"The one with glasses?"
Yale's brain turned slow, arthritic cartwheels. Roman wasn't even supposed to be here. That wasn't Roman. He tried to get a better angle. Roman's glasses. Roman's bony shoulders. "He's a piece of work," Teddy said. "Where do you know him from?"
"I mean..."
Teddy shrugged and laughed. "No, seriously." How many nights had Roman come over? How drunk had Yale been? What had happened exactly, and on what bed and when? He'd been careful about himself, protecting Roman. They hadn't been careful the other way, because Roman was a virgin. Because Roman was a virgin. Yale said, "Tell me."
"He's not that hot, chill out. I met him last year at my friend Michael's lecture at the Cultural Center. He's got this whole tortured artist thing going on, like he just suddenly has to leave the room and be alone."
"Oh." Yale relaxed. "I thought you met him at a bathhouse or something."
"God, Yale, I go other places. I mean..."
He laughed, leaned close.
"I plowed him like a fresh spring field. But we definitely met at the Cultural Center."
Yale let Teddy step ahead of him in line. The park was more sound than color now, more vibration than reality. If he opened his eyes, he'd be in bed next to Charlie, and it would be last summer. He told Teddy he'd be back, and he stepped toward Roman's group, which was still quite far away. He needed to see that it wasn't Roman. The mayor was still talking, and the air still smelled like hot dogs. And yes, it was Roman standing there looking bored, just like his bored and beautiful friends. Yale might have run home and hidden under his blankets. But instead he made his way past a pack of leather dykes, past the guy with the bird, and straight to Roman. Roman tried to angle his body away, a teenager who didn't want his friends knowing that this embarrassing person was his dad. Yale said, "May I have a word?" One of the boys in black hooted. The other said, "Who is she?" Roman opened his mouth as if he wanted to make an excuse not to talk. But then he wiped his brow with the back of his arm and stepped away with Yale. Yale didn't care if Teddy looked over and saw them together. He was far beyond caring. He said, "We'll make this really quick. Did you misrepresent yourself?"
"I'm sorry?
I should have asked you more questions. I should have made you take some kind of written exam. Is this what you do? You go around doing the confused Mormon act? Like, role-playing?" Roman said, "What are you talking about?" His friends were watching, snickering. They were too far away to hear.
"I'm a Mormon. That wasn't a lie."
"But you're a Mormon who sleeps with a lot of men, who's been doing this for a long time."
"Well, no, not a lot. I mean, I used to. I was trying to be monogamous."
For a second, Yale thought Roman meant monogamy with him, that their hazy midnight assignations were meant to be some kind of steady relationship, but that made no sense. And Roman kept talking. "Or like, I had been, and then he was..." Like he felt kind of suffocated, I guess. He was trying to get rid of me, or I thought he was. He wanted me to be with you, and I didn't even really want it. Not that I'm not attracted to you, just, I don't know. But then after that first time in Wisconsin, he knew. And all of a sudden he was so jealous. He wanted me to quit. Yale tried to understand who this boyfriend was who knew about Yale, who knew about Wisconsin, and then he got it. He got it. Roman said, "If you're mad because he fired you or whatever, I mean, I'm mad too, but it's not about us. I mean, really, you quit, right? He likes you. He was seriously bummed when you left. Look, did he tell you to do it? I'm sorry? Since we're already talking, I've always wondered, and it won't hurt my feelings, did he tell you to come on to me that first time? It's so weird. He wanted to push me away, and then ever since it happened, he got possessive as hell. He still... I don't know. Do you think I should leave him?" Yale had too much to work out, and the sun was too hot, and his stomach was too empty, and what he needed to do was go home and find his fucking pocket calendar, go through the whole hellish calculus again. And it should be easier this time. He should feel stronger, knowing he'd already dodged a bullet. But it wouldn't be, because this didn't feel like a bullet, but a cannonball. Roman was still looking at him, earnestly waiting for advice. He'd been nothing but honest, it was true. Whatever Yale had projected onto him was his own fault. Yale said, "Yes, you should leave him. For fuck's sake. He's married to a woman and he smells like mothballs. I need to know if you've been tested." "What, like the... oh, that. I don't know. I keep reading all these things about how it's not really accurate. And also, like, I don't do that kind of stuff." "I'm sorry, what kind of stuff?" "You know, needles and fisting and alleys."
"Needles and fisting and alleys?
You know what I mean?" Yale turned from him without saying goodbye, and he didn't go back to Teddy either. He headed south through the park instead of north, even though he should walk straight to Dr. Chang's office. Well, no. It was Sunday, and it was Pride, and no one would be there. He walked along the harbor and then the lagoon, and he wandered back up to the zoo, and he ended up in the conservatory. He hadn't been inside in ages. A glass bubble of tropical plants. The only sound, the waterfalls. The only light, the filtered sun. He walked back to the third room, the quietest, the emptiest, and he sat down right in the middle of the floor. 2015. Fiona didn't sleep at all, but she waited till morning. When Richard was in the shower and couldn't stop her, she stepped outside onto the eerily quiet streets. The movie production had halted. The vans remained in place, the blockade stacked against the buildings. On nearly every corner stood paratroopers with red berets and machine guns, as if some child had spilled a tub of army toys all over Paris. She was surprised to find a cab. The driver might have been Somali or Ethiopian. He didn't talk. He took her to the address she gave for Claire's bar. And when she saw the gate pulled over the entrance, the hand-lettered sign, she directed him straight back to where he'd found her. Cecily's plane had landed just after the attacks began, and she was at baggage claim when the news reached her. She'd managed to get through to Fiona at 1 in the morning, and by early afternoon she was in Richard's flat, taking her shoes off in the doorway. Fiona hadn't seen her in 10 years, didn't know which changes were exhaustion and which were age. Cecily did look like a grandmother. People in their 70s could be grandmothers. 51-year-olds should still be leading spin classes and staying out too late, in Fiona's opinion. "What happened to your hand?" Cecily asked. And Fiona said, "Stigmata." Cecily didn't laugh. Well, she'd never had much of a sense of humor. Fiona got her some tea, told her about her meeting with Claire, although she didn't quite convey the humiliation. Cecily sat on Richard's couch, her body angled toward the window. She said, "I've never seen Paris before. What a strange time to get here. I hate that we have to live in the middle of history. We make enough mess on our own." Cecily smiled. "I've missed you." Richard says hello. He's gone to his studio. "It's funny, I went out myself today, but it scares me that other people are out. I mean, Richard can't run if something goes wrong." Cecily agreed, and Fiona told her she couldn't reach Claire. Cecily said, "It's natural to worry, but I'm sure she's fine." It hadn't occurred to Fiona till then to worry about Kurt as well. Kurt was more likely to be out at night. She didn't imagine he liked heavy metal, but still. Serge came through the front door then, hair sticking up with sweat, eyes ringed. He nodded at them both and ducked into the bedroom. "I feel I'm imposing," Cecily said, and Fiona assured her she wasn't. "We're all in crisis mode here," she said, "just for different reasons. Listen, what I think we could do is go to Kurt's apartment. Maybe he'd let us have Claire's number, given the situation. And now that I've seen her myself." Cecily examined her unpolished nails. "Better if I go alone, don't you think?" "Maybe. And besides, they'd want privacy. Fiona wouldn't have wanted some third party there when she'd seen Claire the first time." So after some lunch, after Fiona walked her down and got her a cab, Cecily took off for the Marais. She promised to call the instant she knew anything. When Fiona came back upstairs, Serge was in the kitchen with his laptop. "I yelled at you last night," he said. She understood this was his apology. "Your daughter is not on Facebook?" She almost laughed. How much easier that would have made everything. A message to her inbox, rather than flights and detectives. "No," she said. "I'm not either." Damien was, and he'd checked obsessively over the past few years. "So, two things. One is, people can check in safe, like this." She looked over his shoulder, saw a list of names and faces, friends of Serge who'd marked themselves alive. "But here," he said, and he clicked to something new, "this is a forum to ask after people. I write a message, okay?" She nodded, and he started to type. "Claire, what?" She grabbed the grocery pad and pen from beside the stove and wrote for him, "Claire Yale Blanchard." I guess she could be using Pierce for a last name. And she wrote that, too. "Okay," he said. "Posted." "We wait." Dear God, it was exactly what Arnaud had said to her, what felt like 1,000 years ago. "We wait." Damien called, and she filled him in. "Do you think she's scared?" Damien asked. "I hope not. I mean, not more than everyone else. She's not a kid anymore. But she's a mother." "Right," Fiona said. "Right. Maybe this is how we get her home." Fiona doubted it. The chaos of the world had never helped her before. That it might help now seemed ridiculous. She said, "Let's not get greedy." July 15th, 1986. Lake Michigan, impossibly blue. The morning light bouncing toward the city. Lake Michigan frozen in sheets you could walk on but wouldn't dare. Lake Michigan. gray out a high-rise window, indistinguishable from the sky. Bread, hot from the oven, or even stale in the restaurant basket, rescued by salty butter. The Cubs winning the pennant someday. The Cubs winning the series. The Cubs continuing to lose. His favorite song, not yet written. His favorite movie, not yet made. The depth of an oil brushstroke. Chagall's blue windows. Picasso's blue man and his guitar. Dr. Chang said, "I'm going to write down everything I say to you, so you can read it again later." The sound of an old door creaking open. The sound of garlic cooking. The sound of typing. The sound of commercials from the next room when you were in the kitchen getting a drink. The sound of someone else finishing a shower. All of them growing old together on the yacht for old queers that Asher always joked about. Right off the Belmont Rocks, he said, with binoculars for everyone. Art Nouveau streetlights. Elevators with gates. Fiona having kids. Being a surrogate uncle. Buying the kids sweaters and gum and books. Taking them to the museum. Saying, "Your Uncle Nico was a good artist. And maybe you will be too." If it was a girl, letting her paint his nails. If it was a boy, taking him to ball games. You could take a girl to ball games, too. Dr. Chang said, "You're young and you're strong, and you're going to take excellent care of yourself." Good, thick Turkish coffee. Sanka with too much cream after a long dinner. Sad, weak office coffee. The year 2000. The last party of 1999. Red wine, beer, vodka tonics on a summer day. Christmas, which he just really started to love. Getting to Australia someday. Sweden. Japan. Dr. Chang said, "I know the last thing you feel like right now is having more blood drawn, but we're going to get your T-cell count today. Since we know this is a brand new infection, I expect your count to be very strong. So we'll have some good news on top of the bad. We'll do the draw right here." Arthritis, gray hair, bushy eyebrows like his father's, dentures, canes, prostate issues. His 25th high school reunion, he might really have gone, despite everything. A dog he could walk by the lake. Dr. Chang said, "You might not feel like talking at first, but I'm writing down the info for the Test Positive Aware Network support group. It's on the bottom of the first page here." The brutal wind on the L platform. 50 people huddled under the heating lamp. Pigeons crowding at their feet. Owning a house. Painting the door so he could tell his friends to look for the purple door. The foods that hadn't yet made their way to America. The things he hadn't tasted that everyone would be crazy for in 10 years. The way Chicago looked from an airplane window, flying in from the east. The only time you could really see the city's face. Dr. Chang said, "We have no idea what advances are down the road. In my opinion, it's a waiting game. Because better medicine is out there. Some flower in the Amazon, who knows? It could be tomorrow, it could be next year. There's no reason not to believe that at some point there will be survivors." The cement beach up by Bryn Mawr. The psychedelic foot someone had painted there. The next Harvey Milk. The first gay senator. The first gay governor. The first woman president. The last bigoted congressman. Dancing to the floor was an optional landing place. Dancing elbows out. Dancing with arms up. Dancing in a pool of sweat. all the books he hadn't started. The man at Wax Tracks Records with the beautiful eyelashes. The man who sat every Saturday at Nookie's, reading The Economist and eating eggs, his ears always strangely red. The way his own life might have intersected with theirs, given enough time, enough energy, a better universe. The love of his life. Wasn't there supposed to be a love of his life? Dr. Chang said, "Our counselor is here today, and I'm going to have Gretchen walk you down the hall and wait with you till he's available." His body. His own stupid, slow, hairy body. Its ridiculous desires. Its aversions, its fears. The way his left knee cracked in the cold. The sun, the moon, the sky, the stars. The end of every story. Oak trees. Music. Breath. Dr. Chang said, "Whoa there, let's lie down. Let's get you lying down." 2015. Serge said the phone signals were jammed all over the city, which was possibly why Fiona hadn't heard from Claire, and likely why she hadn't heard from Cecily, who'd been gone all afternoon. Fiona had become, throughout the day, simultaneously more and less panicked. Less, because many names of the dead had been released, and Claire's and Nicolette's were not among them. More, because she still hadn't heard anything. Less, again, when she realized the problem with the phones. More, every time she stopped to think about it. At 6 o'clock, Cecily finally buzzed up from the street. "He's with me," she said. It was hard to tell how much, if at all, Cecily and Kurt had reconciled in that time. The fact that he came with her certainly meant something. But they wore matching looks of concern, and the vibe Fiona got was more of two people assisting each other through crisis than of some touching mother-son reunion. They sat a couple of feet apart on the couch. Fiona knew this must be painful for Cecily, but she couldn't imagine being the one, as a mother, who'd broken off contact, the one who'd given up. Well, no. She mustn't confuse it with what her own parents had done to Nico. Cecily had been protecting herself after Kurt stole from her and lied to her again and again. She hadn't rejected a helpless teenager. Still. Kurt said, "I left her 3 messages. The woman whose apartment shared a kitchen with Claire's, he said, would have found a way to get him word if something bad had happened, if Claire had never come home. I'm worried, but I don't have a reason to be worried. And there's no way she was out that late." Fiona didn't mean to shout, but it came out too loud. "Can't you just go over there?" "That's not our... We have an arrangement. Not a legal arrangement. But if I ever showed up when it wasn't my day, she'd split. She's made that crystal clear." Cecily said, "But in an emergency situation..." "No," Kurt said. A siren blasted right outside the window. It was short. Police warning someone to move out of an intersection, maybe. Nevertheless, all three of them jolted, and Fiona's heart started beating like a hamster's. "Give me the address," she said. "I'll say someone at the bar gave it to me, and if that doesn't work, I'll say I tricked you. I broke into your apartment and got it off an envelope." It wouldn't be far from the truth. "No, wait. I'll say the detective found it." Cecily put a hand on Kurt's knee. "Wouldn't that be for the best?" she said. "Then you'd know they were safe." He seemed to relax, rather than bristle under Cecily's touch. If nothing good came of this for Fiona, at least maybe she'd have been responsible for the Pierce family reconciliation. Maybe Cecily could send her weekly updates on Nicolette, as she got to watch her grow up, as Fiona sat home alone in Chicago, Fiona handed him her phone. "Just type it into my GPS," she said. "As far as she knows, I haven't seen you in years." Kurt sighed and took the phone. As soon as she had it back, Fiona grabbed her purse. She said, "If you want to wait here, you can." Kurt squeezed Fiona's shoulder with his giant hand. Saint-Denis was a zoo of blocked-off streets. The cab driver had asked 3 times if she was sure she wanted to head up there. "I wait to make sure you get in," he said. "You here long?" "I wait to drive you back, too." She told him she'd be 3 minutes. She hoped she'd be coming out to tell him he could leave, to give him an extra tip. A young man was heading in the door right ahead of her, so instead of messing with the jumble of buzzers and names, she followed him into the narrow hallway. The place was labyrinthine, but she finally found number 8. A red plastic bucket and green plastic shovel outside the door. She knocked with her uninjured left hand, which felt wrong, unlucky. When Claire opened the door, she left the chain in place. She said,
"What the fuck?"
"Honey, just... No, this is not okay. I had no other way to reach you. This is not okay." Her hair was pulled up sloppily on top of her head. She looked as if she hadn't slept.
"You're safe?"
"Obviously. I'm all right, too, in case you were concerned. Listen, it's her nap time." Claire's voice softened slightly. "This just... I can't deal with this right now."
"I understand."
"I'm not sure you do. Can you give me your number, at least, so I don't have to stalk you at work?"
"I have your number."
"Listen, what's the harm?"
"This is the harm."
"Okay." Fiona put her hands up in surrender. "You're alive. Your daughter's alive. That's all I needed. I'll leave now." Claire let out a loud, angry sigh that Fiona couldn't begin to decipher. Fiona wanted to storm off, but the whole point of coming to Paris, she and her shrink together had been clear on this point, was to put herself out there, to keep her arms open even when Claire closed hers, to be the parent, not the child. She said,
"Call any time. I love you, sweetie."
Claire shut the door without saying anything, without even waving. 1986. That September, Katsu Tatami fell on the street. Someone took him to the ER at Masonic, where he was sent up to the AIDS unit. Teddy reported that Katsu was wishing aloud to die before he was stable enough to be dumped back into county. But he got stable, and back he went. County discharged him almost immediately. Then when he was unable to breathe the next day, they told him they no longer had an available bed. He waited 2 weeks, not quite bad enough to go back to the Masonic ER, until finally, too late to do much good, County readmitted him. Yale knew he had to visit eventually, partly because it was the right thing to do, and partly because, in the worst-case scenario, he'd end up at County himself. And he needed to see it. Needed to get it over with. One night, he pulled on Julian's dental floss and the last of the string came out. Just long enough to use. He tried not to take it as a bad sign, but it felt like one. He decided to visit Katsu the next morning, before it was too late. He'd been a finalist for a job at St. Louis University, and he was still in the running for a regular development job at DePaul, here in the city. But he was still unemployed. Dr. Chang had told him to take the first job that offered insurance. "The bigger the company, the better," Dr. Chang said. "So you'll get lost in the shuffle." Meanwhile, he was on Cobra, which would quickly drain his savings. He could afford it till January, barely, and then he'd have to choose between insurance and food. In the meantime,